my way over.
Of course, that's Jimmy Cliff, Many Rivers to Cross. It occurs to me, talking to people in the community, a lot of younger people don't even know this piece of music, which is pretty amazing. Some of us elders, mature people, know this piece, Many Rivers to Cross. Talk about synchronicity. I heard a piece last Sunday on OPB. Deacon John, I think, who might have been the person who wrote this, and I was in the car and I was so struck I ran over to Everyday Music and dug this up by Jimmy Cliff, thinking to myself, this is the piece I'm going to use on the air. And then I got a call from Stephen after that about his show, not knowing what he was going to do until today, and I thought that was all pretty synchronous. Nice when you're in touch with all that stuff. We're going to go to Michael Mead, Fate and Destiny, in just a minute. But something one of the last callers said was the reality that a number of the great ones are leaving right now, which means that we're going to be seeing incarnation of a lot of the great leaders. And I was struck by that because we've recently lost Coretta Scott King, Rosa Parks, and Shirley Chisholm, three great black women amongst the many great black, white, and other kinds of women that we're losing right now. But these three great national, international leaders in the area of civil rights, which is human rights, are all leaving, which means there are possibly, if you understand these laws of karmic balance, there are going to be incarnations of these greats. And I was struck by that because it has occurred to me for some time now that at the national level, it is the Black Congressional Caucus in the House of Representatives and, you know, a handful of other people. But it is the Black Congressional Caucus that has consistently been the supporters of civil rights, human rights, and the people who are on the path of justice, social justice. It just keeps happening over and over, and they just literally don't buy into this thing that happens with these right-wing fundamentalist, prepaid, air-blown, hair-dried, all that whole crowd that's just not doing its job. In the Senate, we saw this week a vote for, or last week, for cloture. And it was a group of people who wanted to filibuster the nomination of Alito. 25 Democrats in the Senate wanted the filibuster to happen. So that's the core group in the Senate. Those were Democrats. So we need to start paying attention to who they are, and we need to recognize that we do have progressive forces already in place, excuse me, in small numbers, but they're there. And I've been surprised and kind of curious about the fact that we've heard little from libertarians or Greens during this period of time. And I'd like people to think about the possibility that we have this institution, we have a core group of people already there who know how it works. Try to rethink and reformulate in your mind the value of adding to their numbers in their respective houses. And I know that's revolutionary for people who have been programmed to think that there's no difference between the two parties. There is a difference, and those people in the Black Congressional Caucus and the 25 Democratic senators in the Senate, those are the groups of people who represent the differences, and we need to start paying attention to that. Also this week, I just wanted to give you some reason for optimism. And I think there's a lot happening right now that should make people optimistic about the possibility of major change coming soon. The White House is getting quite nervous. We've had some real interesting week in news in the last 24 to 48 hours. I get a sense of the wagons beginning to circle and pushing the White House crowd on the outside. Michael Brown from FEMA is going to testify about the White House's role in the Katrina episode, known to Laura Bush as Karina. And it looks like he may have made a very veiled threat to the White House. He said he would testify if he was given legal support from the White House. So that means he's looking for a trade-off. Excuse me. Scooter Libby, yesterday, it is reported now in the National Journal, through court documents that came out as a result of Fitzgerald's grand jury, has indicated that he was told by his superiors, and he didn't have many, that would be Dick Cheney would be his immediate superior, to release the information about Valerie Plame, the covert CIA agent, and to release that information to the media, and that would be Judy Miller over at the New York Times, in order to put pressure excuse me, on Joe Wilson, who wrote the article in the New York Times questioning the need to go to war in Iraq. So Scooter Libby is now apparently being, his information is being released, which could put Dick Cheney in big trouble. Ron Wyden was on Ed Schultz yesterday and said that within the last 36 hours, and this was yesterday, that there had been a huge change in the bipartisan support now for increasing interest in the spy wiretapping, electronic surveillance activities of the White House to look into those hearings more carefully. So that's a big change. Jack Abramoff, the lobbyist, has revealed numerous emails to Mr. Bush, who denies that he even really knew him. And Abramoff has pictures of his family with Bush's family. They both have twin daughters. There's lots of photos. There are a number of emails. Bush is denying that he even remembers him. Yet Abramoff was a pioneer who raised greater than $100,000 for Bush's campaign. And because his name is Abramoff, starting with AB, he's at the top of the list of pioneers. So Bush clearly knows him, and that's coming out. So that's going to be interesting. Hillary and Dianne Feinstein are doing a little bit of female, showing a little bit of female outrage and disdain. Hillary's taking a real hit, which is not unexpected. But she says to take no backseat to anyone, and that she's not taking a backseat to anyone when it comes to fighting terror. So she's going full bore out for this White House and the way it's presenting information to scare us. And then Dianne Feinstein piped up yesterday after Mr. Bush tried to distract the media with that story about a terror threat that was diverted in Los Angeles several years ago. And Dianne Feinstein, the senator from Democratic senator from California, said that is old news. And then to top it all off, Cindy Sheehan, I think, announced that she's going to run for the Senate from California. And I would guess she's going to go after Feinstein's seat. So that may perk Feinstein up. It's going to be interesting. But the bottom line is we're starting to see some real effort or energy manifesting in Washington, D.C., which indicates that the White House and its inside minions is beginning to be isolated and separated from people of conscience. So I think that's very positive. Okay, now we're going to go to Fate and Destiny, The Two Agreements in Life, Michael Mead. We're in living in mythic times, and I think we need to understand it on a mythic level. It says on the CD, according to ancient myth, there are two agreements each soul must make upon entering the world. The first agreement binds the individual to a destiny that becomes the soul's great experiment in life. The second agreement involves one in the distinct limits of family, culture, time, and place. beginning with the sense that the deep self is a person, in the person is related to the hidden gold in the earth. Michael Mead mines the ground of fate and destiny for fresh insights, revealing how the first agreement must be lived uniquely, or the soul will suffer a fate worse than death. So, we'll go right to Michael Mead, and I'm going to figure out which technology I need to pump up, and there we go. Okay, and that was not the right technology, because this is... No, that was not the right technology either. You see, I'm just, something is happening in the ethers here, and I'm just not getting what I wanted. So now I know what I want, this.
I was thinking this morning of the many things that the earth is and also represents. A core idea that I'm going to be working after from many directions is that inside of each one of us is a mostly hidden, mostly golden, mostly eternal image, presence, aspect of being, similar to the gold that is buried in the earth. We are the earthlings, the children of the earth, and therefore we are a replica, in a sense, of the earth. One of the ideas that I'll present in a little bit more fully is as above, so below. As outside, so within. So, in thinking about the earth as a symbol, which is actually interesting because the earth is usually considered to be the concrete thing, the stable thing below us, but it's also a symbolic thing. Myth, by the way, is the combining of concrete and symbolic things. But within the earth, concretely and symbolically, there are two extremely powerful and hidden things. I mentioned gold, and the other is the fire burning at the center of the earth, which they now think is actually a fire around which there is an open space around which is the earth. So there's another way to imagine the internal life of a person. Inside each one of us, there is a fire similar to that in the earth. There's some space around it, which might explain why we don't just burn up like that, and might explain why it's a little difficult to get in touch with it. Yet, the fire in us, like the fire in earth, is what generates and pushes things out of us, such as words. The very words I'm saying, which I have no idea what they are until I actually feel them going through my own mouth, are generated from an inner fire. And they have heat. Just the way anyone speaking seriously to anyone else, whether it is in conflict or in love, which are like two sides of the same language, anyone speaking in either of those ways is actually communicating things that are born from this fire that is deep inside, which is similar to the fire deep inside the earth. Another way to say that is humans produce language the way the earth produces plants and trees. And the words that come out of people when they are born in this inner, let's say, alchemical fire, have duration, some of them very short duration, like these little flowers that just come up for a while and then they're gone, and others of enduring duration, like the great trees that stand for hundreds of years. So, from that perspective, I'm wanting to connect to the earth here at the beginning. Does that make some sense? So, when it's said in mainstream culture, Earth Day, I'm not sure what it means. I think it's some kind of guilt-oriented bow towards something that otherwise is ignored and exploited and mistreated, you know, from the mainstream. Then you have the environmental awareness groups who have a deeper sense, often related to ecology, And then I guess I'm wanting to add this other related to symbolism and symbology. Just to mention also, if the ecological movement and the earth awareness groups are going to be effective, I think they will have to bring in more of the symbolism and more of the sense of cosmology, because it is so deeply meaningful, and because it sways people, and because I don't think we're living through a time where we need to adjust policy. I think we're living through a time where we need to completely convert the philosophy and understanding of what it is to be a child of the earth. And that doesn't happen except through two things: personal experience of the earth and of nature, radical openings that can happen by direct exposure to the energies of the other world, also called nature, and then through a collective increase in knowledge about what this world is. We're going to be doing the second one: thinking, feeling, and finding our way through the forest of symbols, entering the mythic territory, which is also called the forest of symbols. So the first symbol then, which is also the center of where we always stand, is the earth. So an earth song is the right way to go. You could also say the earth is a song, showing us the right way to go. The earth is one of the spheres spinning through the Milky Way. It's the one that is central to us. And I never can remember numbers, but it is moving very fast. The wonder of the world is that we think of it all as stable, and the earth as the greatest stabilizing thing, and yet it is flying like mad. So, to honor its stability, the fire at the core of it, and its capacity to move rapidly and continue to change while holding a stable center.
Zima wo e, Zima wo, Zima wo, Zima wo, Zima wo. Zima wo, eh. Zima wo, Zima wo, Zima wo, Zima wo.
Praise song, singing praise to the earth in the old way of remembering that we are here because we get to walk on this earth, and we are here because we are the children of this earth. We are the earthlings, those born to walk the earth, those born to find on this goat's earth the feet of our dreams. And so people used to sing praise to the earth with its deep and unending abundance. Praise to the earth that throws up forests and trees, that throws up plants and flowers. Praise to the earth. May we find such an abundance inside us as the earth keeps producing for us and produces whether we give it praise or not. But the old people would say, give praise to the earth and more abundance might come into your life. Give praise to the earth and the gold hidden inside, sown inside the vessel of the self may more easily be found. And in these modern times, when so much has been forgotten, one of the things most often forgotten is respect for and praise for the earth. Even though starting out each day with a little praise to the earth below would limit the spread of depression. Well, at least that's what old people used to say when they sang this song. Azima,
we praise is using our language, our sound, our inner fire to connect to the hearth at the center of the earth. And whatever way we do it is just fine. The process in alchemy connected to the earth is the coagulatio, coagulate. You know how they say, why don't you just get it together? They even say, why don't you get your shit together? Implying another aspect of the earth. The kind of composting aspect. And so getting things together, coming together on an alchemical level is coagulatio. It's connected to the earth. You see, when you look at the processes in alchemy, you'll see roughly the four elements. There's actually more. There's a fifth element, which I'll talk about later. And so in that sense, it's a cosmology. And getting it together turns out not to be the end of the process, but it's kind of the middle. Because what we get together then falls apart, either into, well, either separatio or the great one they have is putrefactio, where everything we got together, you know those moments, life is great, and then it turns to shit again. And it just, and so they give it nice Latin names, you know, because it seems to elevate the idea. But but basically, so what happens then, if you follow that idea, that leads to the idea that the earth is not just the place where it all comes together. It's also the place of welcome. And that leads back to one of the cultural problems, which is on the personal, deep psychological level, our deep self is usually not seen, recognized, and welcomed enough. And then on the very simple, everyday level, we do not get a welcome, typically speaking. One of the practices that I see connected to this road of life and death, since it has so many blockages and obstacles and side trips and reversals, is finding ways to, in a given moment, turn the imagination, the awareness, the attention, whatever word you want to use, from the usual center, which is nowadays called the ego, with its prescribed fears, doubts, uncertainties, anxieties, and willful qualities, back to the other center, the deeper one, called the self. Whether it's a song or a breathing practice, so that the breath is taken in and then it drops towards some mostly unseen but somewhat easily felt center inside, or a gathering of the mind just to remember that there is such an other center is very helpful, because the difficulties experienced pre-verbally in infancy will keep coming back in all kinds of forms in order to find not just change, but healing. And whenever those wounded parts can be consciously tended to, there's an increase of vitality. We become more awake and have more courage for the road we're walking anyway. So I want to read this poem. It's called A Delicate Girl. The terrible grief of being human. Let us drink it all, but with a small difference. Unbeknownst to us, we sit with the old prophets. The moon that rises here cannot be covered with clouds, and in the end, there are no deaths for lovers. Who is the self, then? A delicate girl that flows out when we draw the sword of selfless action. This earth eats men, eats women as well. Yet we are sent to eat this world, this place that tries to fool us with tomorrow, wait until tomorrow. We only outwit that by enjoying this now we have. So we gather this day to celebrate being human. Sometimes we call out low to the tambourines and drums. The fish drink the sea, but the sea doesn't grow smaller. And we eat the clouds in the evening light and become the happy slaves drinking the royal wine. So that's Rumi. And the royal wine is another reference to being close to the self. And in this case, the ego being a happy servant, slave to the presence of the self. And I keep feeling various ways that this language of ego and self is critical, not just for one's personal psychology, but it's often the missing piece in spiritual stuff. There's a tendency, currently in the United States, to take on a spiritual or some kind of practice of that kind, and then to try and leave behind the struggle that is deeply personal. And so I find psychological work and potent ideas around personal psychology to be essential for most Western people in terms of developing spiritual lives. Someone who maybe suddenly decides to learn a cosmology or a system or a religious system, and then seems as if they're becoming another person, and all now that wants to happen is living in this other ocean. And what I've experienced is that there's no way to leave it behind. No matter what temple we go into, it goes in with us. And even in those cases where you leave the shoes outside, the inner shoes, with all of their holes and little nails sticking up that weren't, you know, the shoes that weren't made quite right, go in with us. You get what I'm saying? And so they used to say every genuine education is a psychological education. So every piece of learning has to have a psychological component. The ego is a source of great trouble, although interestingly enough, very specific trouble, specific to each person. But we really can't get where we're going without it. And so one of the processes is the finding ways to open the ego, to crack it and open it. It tends to be a sealed system that believes mostly in itself. When it can be cracked and opened a bit, then the self, like some inner radiance, has a way to shine through. And that shining through, that moving of the deep radiance of the self, when it moves through the body and through the ego, is healing automatically. It heals as it moves through. And so Hafiz, Rumi, the mystical poets are talking about that. They use everything they can think of. Wine, they use God, anything they can grab a hold of that has radiance to refer to it. And many of the stories as well. One of the things that's beautiful about alchemy to me, that's the Western esoteric, mystical, mythological tradition of the interior space of the psyche, is about this relationship between the ego and the deep self. Besides the outer relationships with other people, if I'm not working on the inner relationship between the ego, the shape of personality that I've formed since I've been a child, if I'm not working at the relationship between that and the deep core of vital, expressive self, then I'm really not able to fully be in the relationship outside of myself. I mean, I'm exaggerating that, but I think that's how it goes. In the Western poetic tradition, it's called the realization that something inside myself is golden. It's gold. And years ago, we were working at things, and Robert Bly would always say, the first time you make love, you realize you are a golden being. You know, and then you'd have to add other ideas that for not everybody found that out the first time they made love. Some people found it out the first time they climbed a tree. And some people found it out the first time they really spoke the words that were gathering at the back of their heart. And some people found it out the first time they picked up an instrument. And some people found it the first time they danced. It's all making love, ultimately with the self, or the self's way of making love. From the point of view of alchemy, the ego is absolutely essential. The ego is what holds the theory, even in Buddhism, by the way. If the theory is to get rid of the ego, it's the ego that holds the idea of getting rid of the ego. Right? I mean, just really look at it. If you don't have an ego, you can't imagine getting rid of it. So the very idea that says get rid of the ego requires that the ego hold on to the idea until they both can go away. You get what I'm saying? And I think what Buddhism, which by the way is a reform of Hinduism basically, I mean it occurs like Jainism, they come as a pair in the course of Hinduism. Hinduism got carried away with its many, many gods, and they all had 16 arms too. And it was getting really carried away. You couldn't move without encountering a god or a goddess, and you know, people couldn't go anywhere. And so Buddhism said, okay, we're going to cut that out now. We're going to calm down and go the other way. What? Yeah. Jainism, which is the twin of Buddhism, came out at the same time, was very exaggerated and said, we're going to do away with everything. And we're going to make, you can't even, be careful what you're breathing, because you could be killing microbes or something like that. It became very extremely ascetic. Buddhism went middle ground between the asceticism of Jainism and the kind of wild, ecstatic nature of Hinduism. And my guess is what is going on inside Buddhism is not get rid of the ego, get rid of the excesses of the ego, and shape an ego that can help the devotional, spiritual nature of the deep self. And when it got brought over here, people just took this idea up and said, get rid of your ego. It's totally reckless stuff. First of all, they're not doing it. See? You can't get in and out the door without your ego. Something has to say, doorknob, doorknob, turn it to the right. You know? Something has to say, time to get off the mat. Something's got to do that. And that's called the ego. So I think there's been a really simplification of what's going on. And my guess is, at least as an interim idea, reshaping the ego so that it's in service of the deep self. I like the idea that what's being sought is not just out there, but it's way in here. I like it because of the manic nature of the culture, that, and because it's a culture of appearances and measurements. It really counterpoints that to say that there's something deep, vital, mysterious, mythical, and spiritual inside. and that when the outer world rattles like mad, we can still turn and find it inside. And so what I'm calling the ego is something that can relate to the deep self within. So in alchemy, what they say is the first realization, or the first, they call it the union, or actually they use the Latin conjunctio, the first conjunction of real awakeness or real awareness is when the ego realizes that it isn't the center, but the deep self, which gave rise to it, is. So the first thing is for the ego to realize that, yeah, I'm basically got the key, or I'm out here opening doors and closing doors, but in the long run, I'm here to serve something deep and mysterious inside. That's the first thing. The second thing they say is the second conjunctio, which is when the body joins the self and the ego, and it becomes a consistent, grounded, body-oriented thing. So the second conjunctio, the body, the self or soul, and the ego are all involved, and now it's happening on a consistent basis. Something starts to feel wrong to me. I can feel it rising in my body. I stop. The ego checks in with the self. How are we doing at the current moment? And then the third one, which is really interesting, is when the deep self within comes to an awareness that it is in a conjunction or conjunctio or union with a transcendent divine center. So they call that the three conjunctios. I think it's a beautiful idea and a beautiful system. And I think partly it is so because it's Western, and therefore it uses ideas that hang around in the Western psyche. And second of all, because it gives a role to the ego rather than this pretense that we're going to get rid of it. You know, I mean, I've been with a lot of people that are trying to get rid of their ego, and I found myself falling all over their ego. It was just like spread out everywhere. You know what I'm saying? You know, you got the perfect color purple pillow to sit on, and just exactly the right beads, and you find the exact right place in the meditation hall to sit. That's all ego shit, you know. So anyway, I think it's better to shape that ego so it serves the self rather than to pretend that it's leaving.
We have a little wee bit of airspace that I have to now fool around with and make work for you. So I'm going to give you a little piece of music, and I think I'm not going to do the Dave Emery today because we're in such a different mood. I think what I'm going to go to is continue with some of this mythology, and we'll do Dave Emery next week, the political stuff, after I talk with Eddie, which is kind of a more reasonable time to do that. So let's just see if this works.
Okay. Should we have a story?
Oh, it did work. There it is.
A little story to see where things are at in that regard. Once upon a time, once in another time, once in another place, not this place, but another place. Once in that time, and in that place, there was a servant who served a wealthy family. And one day, he was giving some coins and sent to the marketplace to buy delicacies for the evening's meal. And so, the young servant was going happily along the road, jingling the coins in the pocket of his cloak as he approached the marketplace, and thinking of nothing but the enjoyment of shopping in the open air and enjoying the great market of life, when suddenly he saw coming towards him in the marketplace death, death itself. And knowing the old idea that if you see death coming, and if death should speak to you, that it is your death that is the point of the conversation, the young servant suddenly turned and ran as swiftly as he could. He went directly to the stables, that were nearby at the edge of the marketplace and pulling out the coins that were intended to buy the delicacies for the family that he was servant to. He traded the coins for a horse and immediately jumped on the horse, and he spurred the horse on so that the horse was running quickly out of that town and heading down the road towards the great market town of Samara. And now the servant was riding along as the horse made its way swiftly through the deserts. And the day was passed in that rushing ride, running from death towards the town in the distance. And eventually, as the day was winding itself down and the evening darkness was gathering at the edges of the earth, the young servant arrived at the inn that was at the edge of the town of Samara. And the horse, being overheated now and sweating madly, the young servant pulled up at the inn in order to rest the horse and in order to rest himself. The keeper of the inn came out, and the servant said, "Do you have a room for me?" And the keeper said, "Of course, I have a room if you have something to give me in exchange." And the young servant realized he had nothing to give except the horse that had carried him here, the horse he had exchanged for the coins he had received from the family that had sent him to the market to gather some delicacies. And so quickly he agreed to give the horse to the keeper of the inn. And the horse was then taken to the stables there in order to be cooled and calmed and fed. And the servant himself was shown to a room upstairs in the inn. Being very tired from the ride and the excitement of the day, the servant went directly to the bed that was in the room and laid down. And as soon as he laid down, the lids of his eyes rolled over the orbs of his eyes, and he found himself falling deeper and deeper into a sleep that held him somewhere in the darkness below the earth. And he was in that state for a while, a short time or a long time or whatever time it was, when suddenly he felt the presence of something or someone in the room, and suddenly he sat bolt upright and was looking straight ahead and saw standing at the foot of his bed death himself. And in his great surprise and in a certain amount of fear, he said, "How could you be here? I saw you this morning in the marketplace, and I have run the entire day and ridden a horse in order to escape your presence." And death said, "Of course, and I saw you as well. And what I was intending to say to you before you turned and ran away so quickly was, I will see you tonight in Samara. I will see you tonight in the same place that you are running towards. For in these old stories, they deliver the information that is important to know and worthy of being folded into the folds of one's shirt. That whenever we run, we are running towards our death. Whenever we are running towards the thing that will define and possibly end our lives. That we cannot run away from death. We can only run whenever we run towards it. At least that's what this old story says. And tell me this, if the old tellers don't know, if the old sayers don't know, and if the old stories don't know, well then, who does?" So, the road of life and death. It's an old story, trying to teach something about life, manic behavior, the errand we're on, and death. And maybe just for a minute, sit for a minute and think what strikes you most. Especially the details in the story, anything that might strike you. Every appearance, inner and outer, hides meaning that is also a form of water. What we're after is a delicacy. See, I don't know where its words are going to come out when I'm telling the story. I'm as surprised really often as anybody, and I don't know I've ever actually used that word in the story before. I might say food or something, but delicacy, I think I might have said it 2 or 3 times because I can still hear it in myself. And so that means something very specific that's being sought after. Delicacy is something of the light, and also something delicate is implied, and the presence or the possibility of death chases that out completely. So
as soon as you mention delicacy, food and stuff, you also have the instincts present, which becomes the running horse, the instincts running away. The horse of fear and the horse of desire are both there. So you suddenly see that there's instincts. And there seems to be a connection between turning in the horse and the surprise of being awakened. And you can put yourself in the moment of exchange. When he says, all right, all I have is a horse and I'll give it for a room. And then you can just open that up. And it also could suggest a movement from instincts to the intuition of dreams, if you want to go that way. The mythic internal territory I think of as subtle earth. And what we're doing really together, in my understanding, is we are trying to build some subtle earth together. And one simple untoward thing can earthquake it. Earthquake it. Remember being at an event once where you could feel this earth being made, and someone present really couldn't stand that and figured out a way to disrupt the whole thing. And it was just gone. And you can't get it back. And you can't blame and you can't accuse. And there's nothing to do. It's gone. And so we're in this mutual process of building a subtle ground. That subtle ground is also called the imagination. And the coarseness and the speed of the world now doesn't allow the subtle earth to be made. And so people feel like we're all running from each other. And increasingly people begin to represent death to each other. And that's also a way of understanding our individual psyches. The issues that we would like to get rid of are waiting for us when we lay down. They come back in dreams. I forget what Freud said, but it was something to the effect of the repressed will always surface. The thing which feels deadly to us, I can't stand it because it's like a deadly pain, or I can't stand it because it stops everything, it will always come back. And then the issue is what strikes each one of us is what's important. And one of the hardest things is to trust one's own psyche. That I'm thinking about this because this is what I'm thinking about. And that this is not accidental or fleeting, that this is the appearance trying to give me the meaning. Stories are psychodiagnostic. You can diagnose your current psychic condition through what strikes you in a story. And so just like a dream, it's a practice in trusting one's own psyche. The story is like a big X-ray machine on a psychic level, believe me. And it is so accurate that it is hard to believe. And the second hard to believe thing is it reveals to us exactly where we are, and we can trust our own connections, our own psychic imaginal connections, because they are accurate beyond counting. And yet it's a hard thing to do, because we have actually been trained away from it through most of our life. You know, imagine being a little kid. You know that one where you wake up with a dream and they say it's just a dream, and you're going, you don't realize my whole room is full of snakes and you're saying it's just a dream. And then you say, well, we'll turn on the little light and you'll feel better. No, because I close my eyes and the snakes are there again. You know, and so we've been trained away from the instinctive and intuitive knowledge of where we're actually at. And one of the works in mythic territory is to begin to work our way back to it through stories, through our personal feelings and thoughts and images, and through dreams.
Okay, boy, that's pretty heavy stuff, and so synchronous with what Stephen did again today. It's lovely when that all comes together. It's one of my favorite things about doing this work is the amount of synchronicity that plays out in my life around these shows. So that's pretty good, and hope it works for you. Now, Pear Fagering called in, dear Pear, and said Cindy Sheehan is no longer running for the Senate. I don't know the full story on that, but I'm sure we'll find out more about that, because I mentioned earlier that she had made an announcement, but apparently that's not happening. Number two, 100,000 apologies to the person who called and said, finally, Dave Emery will be on again. Thank you, blah, blah, blah. I'm so sorry that you got pumped up today and it won't be on today, but he will be on next week. That I will promise. I'm going to try to keep the political with the political. And today the myth just seemed to resonate better with the show that we did with Stephen this morning about passages and transitions, and because of the full moon coming up and all of that portends. And then finally, another listener called, and I had mentioned Many Rivers to Cross, the Jimmy Cliff piece that I found this week that worked into the show as well. And he or she recommended Gospel Songs from the Blind Boys of Alabama, an album called Higher Ground, which we didn't have, and we didn't have the amazing gospel album, but I did find some other pieces. And so in honor of those who have departed, those great black civil rights women, great leaders, Coretta Scott King, the most recent, Rosa Parks, and Shirley Chisholm, all departed, and because we don't always understand how the Southern tradition, particularly the Southern African-American tradition, honors death. It's quite different from the way the Anglo-Calvinist Protestant tradition deals with it. It's a really going home ceremony. And so with that in mind, I'm going to close the show with the Black Boys of Alabama doing Amazing Grace with the kind of sentiment and sound you would probably hear if you were in the actual church itself. So let's go to that.
Yeah! can look like I can look like I can look like I can look like I can oh look like I can see.
That, of course, the Blind Boys of Alabama, gorgeous, gorgeous take on Amazing Grace in honor of so many great black leaders, female leaders, which is not to discount all the other great people, male and female, but so recently, Coretta Scott King, Shirley Chisholm, and Rosa Parks. Kind of overwhelmed by all that. Quick PSA, and then I think we'll just close out with what little time we've got with another piece from the Blind Boys of Alabama, Spirit of the Lord Coming Down. Hang on.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the third annual Oregon Queer Youth Conference. The conference is open to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transsexual, queer, questioning, and intersex youth and their allies under the age of 23 to get together, discuss the issues, and have a crazy cool time. The conference takes place at the Caitlin Gable School, located at 8825 Southwest Barnes Road, on Saturday, February 25th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information, go to www.oqyc.org.
Okay, it's Marlene. I just want to say goodbye and thank you for listening today. That's the Blind Boys of Alabama in the background as I sign off. It's 11 o'clock. You're listening to your community radio station, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 on the FM band. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all of you who called in and said such nice things about the show and about what we're trying to do here. And blessings to everybody. And, hey, happy Valentine's Day. It's the big time for heart.
Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Vice President Cheney, according to...